3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7am until 8:30am.
Only double.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. This is Priya, and I'm in the studio with Kate and Leela. Good morning.
Good morning, Priya.
Good morning. How are we?
Very chilly. Bit chilly.
Very cold. I think the romance of winter has worn off for me.
Oh, I mean, it was kind of cool, though, this morning. Very spooky riding in.
It was spooky.
Because it's so, when the fog sort of settles, it dampens all the sound, and then it feels very eerie.
It was very quiet.
Which is, but it's kind of nice because, honestly, temperature-wise, it is better than completely clear, because then it would have been even colder.
Better than the 2 degrees it was on Monday morning.
Yes. Well, silver linings, right? We have a packed show for you, as always, and we have some really, really exciting interviews as part of today's program. So maybe we'll jump straight into talking about what we've got on. First up, we are very fortunate to be joined by Gunajamara writer, activist and singer Richard J. Frankland, who is speaking with us about screening his film No Way to Forget at Acme tonight as part of NAIDOC Shorts. And he's also going to be talking about his new album, Discovering Lirpin Mara, which was released last month. And NAIDOC Shorts is running as part of NAIDOC Week's 50 Years of Deadly Celebrations this week.
And after that, we will hear from Tash Wock, Branch Secretary of Australian Services Union, who will talk us through current action by council workers against various local government councils across Melbourne. We'll also discuss recent strikes held by waste collection drivers across Darebin, Merribeck and Hume councils, and where their action is up to and the responsiveness of local government councils and the state government.
And then after that, we're going to listen to a conversation that I had last night with Martin Hodgson of the Disappeared Project. And we talked about the family of Monique Club's campaign to get Queensland Police to issue a $1 million reward for information about her disappearance on the 22nd of June in 2013. Monique Club was a Butchala and Wapabara woman. She is dearly missed by her family, and the Disappeared Project is helping the family to amplify her case and try and make sure that the family can get some closure and some justice.
What an important conversation. It's really crucial that we keep that in the spotlight. And then after that interview, we will jump to a conversation with Renters and Housing Union Secretary Ardu Hani and Branch Delegate Harry Millward to go over some of the most recent changes in Victorian rental policy and how these changes could be reworked to actually provide safe and equitable housing for all.
Finally, we'll be joined by Karina Lester, a Yang Yada Anangu leader and second-generation survivor of British nuclear tests at Emu Field in South Australia. She will be speaking with us about her recent role with the AUKUS public inquiry and some nuclear waste concerns we may have around that.
Yeah, amazing. This has... this is a massive, massive lineup. I'm so excited for today's show. So stay with us. We'll be with you all the way through to 8:30 in the morning, but we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
You are listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 9th of July. The Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion continues to be called out for its prominence of pro-Israel and anti-Palestinian witnesses. Refusal of Palestinian voices and focus on criticism of Israel rather than anti-Semitism. Pro-Israel lobbyist Arsen Ostrovsky, who gave evidence last week, has, on his social media, publicly said there are, quote, no civilians in Gaza, end quote, and shared posts about the disproved narrative that babies were beheaded on October 7 at Kfar Aza, as well as other content dehumanizing Palestinians.
Also in news this week, a widespread Telstra network outage yesterday disrupted mobile and data services across the country, affecting payment systems and temporarily shutting down regional rail networks in Victoria and New South Wales. Transport experts say this highlighted how modern rail networks heavily rely on telecommunications infrastructure, and that the incident should prompt a broader conversation about building more resilient transport networks that can tolerate faults without bringing an entire network to a standstill.
In other news, the Victorian government has introduced a bill that, if passed, will limit the right of people in prisons to access the open air. The Australian National Preventive Mechanism says the bill, which would allow these restrictions if prison operational pressures require them, undermines protections under the state's Human Rights Act. Their joint statement said, quote, all people deprived of their liberty have the right to be treated with humanity and with respect. Protecting the right to access the open air is an important safeguard to achieve this, end quote. The proposed bill from the state Labor government follows a January Supreme Court ruling that Corrections Victoria acted unlawfully by denying prisoners in several units at the Metropolitan Remand Centre and Barwon Prison their minimum daily entitlement to open air.
Finally, in headlines, Tonga's decision to join the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty has been welcomed, with anti-nuclear advocates saying the move reinforces the Pacific leadership on nuclear disarmament. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons Australia is urging the Albanese government to sign the UN Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty, and said the government's continued reliance on nuclear deterrence and defence agreements, including AUKUS, is at odds with priorities of Pacific nations.
Now, just something quickly to follow on from that headline about proposed legislation to limit prisoners' access to open air. We wanted to remind you that 3CR is running our annual NAIDOC Week Beyond the Bars broadcast this week from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. every day from the 6th to the 10th of July. So we'll be broadcasting again today and tomorrow live from Victorian prisons, where you will hear the voices of mob inside talking about their experiences, sharing their creative talents, and breaking through the walls to connect with folks on the outside. So make sure to stay tuned from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Every day until the 10th of July. Now, these have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 9th of July, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Every day, people in prisons across Australia are subjected to strip searching. It is an unnecessary, degrading, and deeply harmful practice that must end. It involves a person literally being stripped of their dignity, forced to remove their clothing for their bodies to be inspected by prison guards, being forced to submit to humiliating requests like bending, squatting, and spreading their legs. In many prisons, people are subjected to this repeatedly and routinely. Children as young as 10 years old are being forced to remove their clothes and have their bodies inspected by adults. We're calling on the federal government to stop state-sanctioned violence by ending the routine, unregulated use of strip searching in prisons across Australia. Go to endstripsearching.com. Together, we can demand a system that upholds dignity, safety, and human rights. Fig Jam is a 3CR supporter.
They're pulling on the boots in Brazil and wiping off the eggshells in Moorabbin. Fascism's on the march, and we say, yeah, nah, Yen Up Us Iran is a new weekly program on 3CR dedicated to tracking this rise in Australia, Aotearoa, and all around our increasingly warm little globe. Every Thursday at 4:30 p.m, we'll be talking to writers and fighters about some angry blighters.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist crew.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 on the AM dial podcast. Streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:11 in the morning, and we are now about to head into our first interview with Gunjamara writer, activist, and singer Richard J. Franklin, who's going to be speaking with us about screening his film No Way to Forget at Acme tonight as part of NAIDOC Shorts, as well as about his new album, Discovering Lirpin Mara, which was released last month. Now, earlier this week, Richard delivered this year's Elder in Residence oration for NITV, and we're going to include a link to that in our show notes, which you can listen back to. And we wanted to let you know that NAIDOC Shorts is running from 7 to 8:30 tonight at Acme, screening a selection of films created by First Nations filmmakers over the past 50 years as part of NAIDOC Week's 50 Years of Deadly Celebrations. Good morning, Richard. How are you today?
Very good, thank you. Although I do have a touch of man flu.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I hope that you feel better soon.
Thank you.
It's a real chilly one this morning, and I can imagine extremely cold out west.
It's very bloody cold down here on Gunditjmara country.
Yeah, well, I guess I wanted to ask firstly, as to open up our conversation, it's the 50th anniversary of NAIDOC Week. Now, that's a massive milestone, and I was hoping to hear your thoughts about what NAIDOC Week has looked like over the years and, yeah, to get your reflections on what it means to celebrate this massive anniversary.
Oh, it's a tremendous honour to be part of it. I've seen it grow, NAIDOC Week grow, through the tenacity and courage of people coming together and linking arms, where it used to be a reasonably small event, to now being celebrated right across the country with allies involved, bands, music, films, people celebrating with so many different types of events, language becoming stronger, NAIDOC becoming a household word, particularly in First Nation homes. This growth has brought about pride and strength and encouraged a lot of hope and resilience. It's self-evident of resilience.
And it's such a beautiful celebration and a week for, I guess, reflection on the amazing and diverse and creative contributions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples alongside political struggle and ongoing advocacy. And I wanted to ask about how those come together in something of yours that's going to be screened tonight. Now, No Way to Forget is a film that you created in 1996, and it includes, the journey that you went on as a field officer as part of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody. Can you talk to our listeners about what it was like to make that film and what it means to screen it now?
At that period, when the film was made, there was some 10,000 hours of film footage with First Nations subject or content matter, and well over 95% of it was written, directed and produced by non-Aboriginal people. So they were telling our stories through their eyes. So we didn't have a correct lens. We had their lens on what we were experiencing. And with that was a socially engineered attitude toward us as victims or the noble savage or mainly exotic plumage. And my brother, Wal Saunders, was heading up the Indigenous branch of the AFC. And I did the cross-culturals for them. And we fought really hard, along with people like John Harding and many, many others, to get films made. There was a competition, and I think 76 people applied. 10 of us were selected for workshops, and 6 of us got to make films. Making the film at the time was against the odds. While we had a lot of support, there was still a lot of resistance, people judging and assessing, and we were under intense scrutiny. And I've heard it said that they're the most, those 6 films are the most successful films ever out of Australia.
Wow.
I was lucky enough to, the film was lucky enough to win lots of awards and recognitions. But there were 5 other filmmakers who all went on to do wondrous things in the industry in a variety of ways. It's quite amazing. When we think of systemic discrimination, we need to think not only what it costs the individual, but what does it cost us as a nation?
Mm.
And without these brave people kicking doors open, facing systemic discrimination and staring it down and winning, we wouldn't have these films, and our film industry certainly wouldn't be in the shape that it's in.
Yeah. I mean, the influence of, you know, the first generations of First Nations filmmakers in, as you said, kicking down those doors, in carving out that space and holding that space for younger creatives to be able to continue that lineage of storytelling in film, you know, can't be overestimated. And I was also wondering if you could talk about the content of the film and, you know, what it means to convey the journey through the Royal Commission in this way, and why it's important for people to engage with the story that's being told. You know, what changes when people watch the film?
So it humanises what's been dehumanised. So the film itself is essentially about that. It's about saying we're not just statistics. We're not just the undifferentiated other. We're humans who are suffering immeasurable grief and trauma at a multitude of levels. And these family members of the deceased suffer, but and also the frontline workers. And the frontline workers in First Nations Australia take on enormous loads, enormous cultural loads, and they're constantly experiencing vicarious trauma by the absorbing the grief of community, of their own families, their own grief, and their own pressures. And then navigating, which is another trauma, constantly the dominant cultural bureaucracies and processes. So the film is really about that. It's about the pain of that. It's about how the load wears you down and how you've got to rise up constantly. You can't give up. You have to fight. You have to resist and be resilient. And primarily you have to have hope. Even though the hope might be remote, about justice, you can't stop the quest for justice, for equity, for cultural revival, ongoing cultural maintenance, and ultimately cultural survival.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a thread that has existed through your work in a variety of different arenas, you know, keeping those concerns and keeping that fire burning across your various areas of work. And I also wanted to ask you about, you know, the role of music in your life and about what it was like to develop your new album, which is titled Discovering Lirpin Mara.
So Discovering the Songman, I'd stopped playing music. And there were enough people out there, I thought. And I was working as a cultural mentor and doing workshops. And I was happy enough just to play music on my veranda. And a mate of mine came down for me to look at his book. Mark Holden, and he heard some of the songs. And he was adamant that the songs get heard again with a new lens on them. So we rewrote some of the songs and he produced them. And we had a great time doing it. It was hard work. We revisited some old songs and we also wrote some new ones. And the purpose of it for me was always what the purpose of my music was. It was to challenge the very cultural fabric of Australia. To say we're here, we've not only survived, we've thrived, and this is our lens on who Australia was, who it is now, and who it can be. The songs touch a range of issues, from veteran suicide to marching in the street to more the gathering of clans, a song called River to the Sea, which I wrote 15, 20 years ago, which is about the river people coming down to meet the saltwater people. So it's almost ceremonial. And there's other songs which aren't necessarily in this album that surround it that are cultural as well.
Mm.
So it was a new experience for me producing songs at that level with musicians I hadn't met. Some that I'd worked with, Lee Sonny Boy Morgan, a countryman of mine. I've worked with him for a long time on and off over the years. And they came out and I'm really pleased that we chose a language name because this song man, this Lupin Ma, then this Koi Koi Ma, this story man, had hung up his guitar. But I'm very grateful that Mark dug me out again.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful, beautiful thing to come back to be able to lean back into a practice that sustains you and to share those stories and that wisdom and that fight through music again. I'm wondering, how's the album being received?
Oh, we charted a couple of times, which two songs were on the AMSA charts. Which was quite a surprise for me, and a couple of other songs have been flogged pretty hard on radio. It's a real surprise to me. I didn't expect it. I had to take some leave without pay from work so I could keep up with the interviews and so on. I was really pleasantly surprised, and I was deeply honoured.
Yeah, that's wonderful to hear. Now, I wanted to ask, as we close, is there anything else that you'd like to share about what you've been looking forward to this NAIDOC week and in the year to come?
I would love to see more of the community coming together, to see each other as great warriors and contributors, to find the positives in our mob. I'd like to see non-Aboriginal people challenge themselves about who Australia was and is. I'd like to see more First Nation voice out there and our diversity, our amazing diversity, which isn't just cultural in the sense of a different country, but is our diversity is about our politics, our music, our art, and it just makes us all richer. I'd like to see, most of all, that wonderful, wonderful spirit, that bring out that breath of spirit that is hope. I'd like to see that floating to the surface more and more. And I'd like us to see each other as great warriors, great contributors.
That is a beautiful note to leave it on. Thank you so much, Uncle. It's really been a privilege to speak with you, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of the week.
Much love and be deadly.
Thank you. And that was Gunatjmara writer, activist and singer Richard J. Franklin, who spoke with us about creating and screening the film No Way to Forget, which plays tonight at ACME as part of NAIDOC Shorts for 50 Years of Deadly Celebrations. And we also talked about the development of his new album, Discovering Lirpin Mara, which was released last month. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, he delivered this year's Elder in Residence Oration for NITV earlier this week, and we will have a link to listen back to that in our show notes. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:25 in the morning.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from SoCord Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! You're listening to Community Radio 3CR 855 AM, and I'm having to collect myself a little bit after that interview, Priya. Yeah, it was just beautiful. And coming up, we have just as exciting interview with Tash Walk, who is the Branch Secretary of Australian Services Union. She joins us now to talk us through current action being held by council workers across various local government councils in and around Melbourne, including action by waste collection workers. Thank you so much for being on the show, Tash.
Thanks for having me, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. So Australian Services Union unions are currently supporting strikes being held by council workers. I was just wondering if you could run us through, across the board, what these strikes are calling for.
Sure. So what we've got happening is industrial action happening across 8 metropolitan councils across Melbourne. So those councils are the City of Melbourne, Greater Dandenong, Darebin, Hobsons Bay, Hume, Maribyrnong, Merribeck, and lucky last being City of Yarra. So those councils or ASU members and also the ANU, got ANMF and Professionals Australia members supporting this as well, are all involved in a multi-employer bargaining campaign. So we've had lots of consultation with members for quite a long time now. So because their agreements all expired in the middle of the year last year, to bargain together to try and break the back of getting progressively lower pay rises, from their employers and really try and deal with, what's causing some of that wage suppression.
Mm. And as I understand it, this is sort of a first example of the multi workplace bargaining action, which is a bit exciting. And so waste collection workers are a part of the strikes. I've often watched them operating solo as they manoeuvre and empty the bins, and I've always thought, like, it's a lot. It's a lot of work. And I was wondering, like, what the particular demands of waste collection workers are and what their action is looking to improve.
Sure. So just a quick thing. So it's actually not our first local government multi-employer agreement.
Oh.
We did win one with workers from Central Goldfields Shire Council and Ararat Rural City. So again, that was the first local government multi-employer agreement in the country.
Oh, thank you.
So Yes, and that took quite a long time to achieve because, again, employers tried to obstruct this every step of the way, and we took it all the way to the federal court. Members at Central Goldfields Shire took hold of industrial action. Ararat, as a council, actually consented, which employers can do. It's just that I think they're the only council to consent so far of all of the councils that we are doing this with. So that was really kind of our first experiment. Members there did an amazing job at getting that across the line. But going to your question regarding waste workers, I mean, this is a claim that all members are really supporting one another across those eight councils, across all of the diverse work groups that we see in our councils. Obviously, waste gets a lot of attention. If people's bins aren't picked up, particularly residential bins, then that tends to get, you know, attention very, very quickly and focus people's minds about all of the amazing jobs that happen across local government, and that where they become very visible when they stop happening. So local government workers across the board really make sure that our communities run smoothly. So waste workers, along with others, are really standing together to deal with, as I said before, the wage suppression. What that means is a claim in this agreement is that they are looking for 10% in the first year of the agreement, followed by 4%, 4%, 4%. So over the life of the agreement, it's about 23.7%. Mm-hmm. It goes some way to addressing how far wages have fallen behind in each of those eight councils, because, you know, our estimate is just over the last, you know, round of agreements, it's probably about 7 to 12% that our members are behind. Wow. And that was the biggest issue by far when we went out and started doing preparation for bargaining. Obviously, get all sorts of workplace issues that members want to see addressed, but pay just stood out like well and truly heads and shoulders above all of the other issues that were coming up in that kind of consultation process. So we really, really sought to try and focus on having a shorter log of claims. Like, I still want to deal with other, you know, items in this round, and had a really great win that it'd be good to share, if that's okay. Yes, City of Melbourne has had this strange system for over 10 years, I think now, of having two sets of workers in their agreement. So I think it was pre and post about 2017, workers that got pay point progression and workers that only got pay point progression if the employer felt like giving it. So you can imagine that pretty much after 2017, virtually no one got pay point progression. Mm-hmm. So they got the annual, you know, increase that everybody gets. But that kind of increase that people usually get till they hit the top of their band for being increasingly efficient and productive and knowing their job better and all of that kind of stuff did not happen for the majority of the workplace. And the delegates there who've been involved in bargaining for, you know, well over 10 years, who fought for that every step of the way, are firmly of the view that, you know, it's through this, you know, collective action across all of the councils through multi-employer bargaining that they've gotten that outcome.
Mm, yeah, very exciting. And in terms of what action is, where action's up to now, I'm just wondering where the negotiations are up to and if local councils and the state government have been responsive.
So we are at the bargaining table roughly every fortnight. We've had some slow kind of progress with the employers. We think that things are starting to get a little bit more constructive at the table, but do want to see this move on and do want to see them. They have not yet tabled a wage offer to our members' claims, which obviously is a pretty key piece of the puzzle here. So we're about six or seven meetings in. We've had some, you know, annoying steps along the way of them taking a long time to come to the table, legal kind of barriers and so forth that we've chipped away at. I've had two big stop works with all of the councils walking off together for 24 hours each in May and June. Back in April, we had our waste members at the three councils who still have in-house waste did a stop work as well. So that would be at Hume and Marybeck and Darabin. Everybody else has contracted out their waste, which is shameful. We are talking to councillors in each of those councils to the degree that they will engage. We are definitely talking to the state government as well, because part of what is driving some of this wage suppression is a rate capping policy, which means that rates only go up by a certain percentage across the whole state every year, and that amount is set towards the end of the calendar year each year. And there are just, you know, councils that will not be able to, likely won't be able to meet that 10% claim without some kind of release on that.
So there's a little bit of responsibility that falls each on local government councils and the state government.
Exactly right. So we are trying to break that, and I think we're getting somewhere, we hope, of councils just kind of saying, well, we can't do anything, hands up in the air, you know, pointing at the state government saying this is all about rate capping and whatever, and they are not really campaigning effectively or advocating effectively to change that we can see, and the state government saying, well, you know, this is an employer relationship, we can't get involved. So this is a situation where there is state legislation that firmly affects how councils are run, and the state government does give direction to councils around a range of things. We also know that councillors will often step back and say, well, that's an employment-related matter and we can't do anything about that. However, they're responsible for budget setting and they're responsible for the performance of their CEOs. And in some cases, the CEOs could be doing more and they're not.
Yes, and you briefly touched on the stop works of the waste collection workers, and I'm just wondering how the broader community has responded to this campaign and if they have been supportive.
I mean, I think, as I said before, you know, communities really notice when their bins aren't picked up, and given some of the changes to waste collection and residential waste collection, then I think, you know, all the more so. It's not the case that all bins get collected every week in every council. So, I mean, definitely, you know, there's been feedback that has been, I think there's been some frustration. I think there's been some, at the same time, a lot of expression of solidarity and support for members that this is something that is a crucial community service for keeping, you know, our communities safe and clean, and that people want to see a quality service, and part of a quality service is having like a well-supported workforce that is remunerated adequately.
Yeah.
So we think that, you know, there's always going to be a little bit of, I think councils are easy targets to have a crack at sometimes, including council workers, which is unfortunate when it happens. But I think what we've seen is more positive support in support of what members are seeking.
It is really nice to hear that there has been solidarity witnessed. That's, yeah, very heartwarming. And in terms of...
And I want to do a shout-out, if that's okay, just to some of the people who have done...
Of course, yeah.
...community rallies in front of council meetings. And, you know, like, this is a campaign that is obviously the union office is very, very heavily backing and, you know, we've put a lot of time and energy and thinking into this. But for the delegates who are involved in that campaign, like, this is now... You know, coming on to, you know, probably 18 months, 2 years of planning, activism, you know, constant meetings, you know, being organised, talking to people in their workplaces, like that's a long time.
Mm.
But for the community support that has come through and some of the groups that have been really supportive, like I just, yeah, let's do a massive shout. Sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, that's lovely. And, yeah, it's nice that there is that, you know, unified solidarity and persistence and ongoing determination. And in terms of next steps for the campaign, is there anything that we can be expecting going forward, and how can the community get involved if they're interested in getting involved?
Perfect, thank you. So off the back at the last stop work that we held, we had about 2,000 members walk off the job and all gather in front of Trades Hall, march to Parliament and then around to a local government kind of bosses meeting that was going on. Excuse me, sorry about my voice.
No, you're fine. That happened to me last week, or the week before, so no worries.
Keep going around. Yeah. So members undertook at that stop work to start looking at bans again. So we've got members who are in the process now of implementing bans and planning bans in each of their workplaces. What we do when that happens is we'll go around and consult with lots of different work groups, whether that's outdoor workers. So it was out yesterday morning at a depot. We've got, you know, workers from parks and gardens, roads, infrastructure, et cetera, all talking about the kinds of bans that they can start putting on again. All of that visibility stuff should be there. So people seeing, you know, trucks going past with, you know, slogans on the side, you know, on buildings, et cetera. Each council group of members has probably got a little bit of their own local strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So probably what we're looking at is, you know, some groups of members have already done things like having rallies at council meetings. There'll definitely be some more coming up. People can keep an eye on our socials, so the ASU VicTas social media on Facebook and on Instagram for any other kind of action that's going on. I'm pretty sure we've got a megaphone petition or two rotating around. And, yeah, I think just if you're in one of those eight councils or you work or live in one of those eight councils, is you know, writing to your councillors and just saying, and to the CEO, and saying that you want to see this in like industrial campaign resolved, that you think that council workers deserve a fair pay rise.
Mm. Thank you so much, Tash. And we can provide links to the socials that you mentioned in our show notes so that people can access those. And yeah, thank you so much for being on the show, Tash. It's been really great speaking with you.
Likewise, Kate. Have a great day and really appreciate your interest in what our members are doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and that was Tash Warke, Branch Secretary of the Australian Services Union, talking about current actions by council workers across various local government councils around Melbourne. It is 7:40 in the morning.
Tune in to the Beyond the Bars Prison Broadcast during NAIDOC Week 2026. Listen to 3CR each weekday at 11 a.m. from Monday the 6th through to Friday the 10th of July. We'll take you inside six Victorian prisons: Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, Barwon Prison, Fulham Correctional Centre, Loddon Prison, Marganite Correctional Centre and Western Plains Correctional Centre. There'll be stories, songs, opinions and poems from the men and women inside while connecting with culture and community. The shows will be live on 3CR 855 on your AM dial, 3CR Digital, and streaming via our website or the Community Radio Plus app. Head to 3cr.org.au/beyondthebars2026 for more information.
This country's black future is a fire. With the right season, that burning school fire.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. If you are just joining us, earlier on the show, we were joined by Uncle Richard Franklin Gunjamara, writer, activist and singer, speaking about screening his film No Way to Forget as part of NAIDOC Shorts tonight, and about his new album, Discovering Lirpin Mara. And before and after that, we heard from Tash Warke, Branch Secretary of the Australian Services Union, about council worker actions across various local government councils in Melbourne. We are now going to an interview that I did earlier this week, or should I say last night, which is earlier this week, but it's not a, it's recent. So we're going to an interview that I did with Martin Hodgson of the Disappeared Project. And Martin talked with me about the Family of Monique Club's campaign to get Queensland Police to issue a $1 million reward for information about her disappearance in 2013. Now, it has been 13 years since Butchala and Wapabara woman Monique Club was disappeared. She was last seen in a park next to the Beenleigh Marketplace in Queensland, and her family have not stopped searching for her. We refer to a couple of different things in this interview, including episode of Curtin the Podcast, a article by Amy McQuire on the Black Witness Substack, and a petition as well that the family is running to get that $1 million reward issued. So we'll have links to all of that in our show notes. And we also want to let people know that this interview does contain sensitive material. It includes discussion of a First Nations person who has passed away. And so if mob need any support, you can always call 13YARN on 139276. That's 139276. Or Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563. That's 1-800-959-563. Now let's hear Martin from the Disappeared Project speaking about the case of Monique Club. Martin, thank you for making the time to speak with me.
It's always a pleasure, and we really appreciate the support.
Of course. And when you say we, I know you're speaking as part of the Disappeared Project here. And I think since you've sort of emerged as an organization, there's been an incredible amount of work that you've done to uplift the voices and the stories of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have been forcibly disappeared, and whose stories are, you know, the minimization of their stories are often such an active part of their physical disappearance as well. I've recently read the article published by Amy McQuire on Black Witness about Monique Clubb and about her family and their search for justice. And I wanted to begin there by asking about Monique. You know, what do her family want people to know about her life and her story? Because we know that she's been disappeared, but who was Monique?
Yeah, it's a really important question. Monique was the glue. She held her family together. Still to this day, her younger siblings, she has a big family, call her big sister. And because she really played that big sister role and kept everyone together. She was full of love. She had a big friendship group. She had always a lot of people around her, but particularly her siblings and her younger siblings. They often describe her too like a second mum as well. Her mother, Sheena, was studying and working through that time. And so Monique was a big part of her siblings' childhood too. And one of the things they always say is that no matter where she was or what Monique was doing, she was always keeping in touch, seeing how everyone was, checking in on everyone. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest legacy that Monique leaves behind and why she's so missed is because she was such this central figure in her family and in the broader community. Everyone knew Monique. Everyone knew Monique was always there for them and to talk to. And, yeah, she was kind of a big sister to a lot of people.
Yeah, and I mean, this makes what happened on the 22nd of June, 2013, even more significant. Monique was never out of regular contact with her family until that day. What do we know about what happened?
Yeah, so Monique was south of Brisbane, about an hour and a half away from home and in Hervey Bay. And there's quite a lot of detail that if people want to go and read or listen to the Curtin podcast episode on Monique. But basically, she had gone to a doctor, then gone to a pharmacy and ended up on her own. And once she'd gone into a park in the Binley area, she'd never been seen again. And the biggest thing for her family that raised immediate concern was she hadn't run. No one had heard from her. And she'd spoken to her siblings and her mum every day. She'd been away for a couple of days in Brisbane. And, yep, she was coming home. These were the people that were giving her a lift home. This was where she was. And then just complete radio silence. It's like she literally disappeared off the face of the earth. And there has really been no answers since. There is one still image of Monique from a train station in Binley in Brisbane. And other than that, that's all that's ever been confirmed.
So in terms of the process then, when Monique went missing, what happened? And what was the response from the Queensland Police Service?
Yeah, so the Queensland Police Service made the assumption that Monique had died from a drug overdose in that park. And we know from the coronial inquest and everything we've learned before and after that that's not correct. The coroner found that Queensland Police acted outside of their own operations manual, that the investigation was incomplete and incompetent, and that the head of Queensland Search and Rescue said from the very beginning of his investigation, Monique was not in that park. And yet that was as far as the police investigation ever progressed.
And making the assumption that she had passed away in that park suggests that Monique has been found, but she hasn't. Monique is still missing and her family is asking for answers. What's the conversation been like with Queensland Police through the courts and through the process of public advocacy that the family has been involved in? Have things changed over time? How's that process been?
Yeah, I think things do change over time. Largely it is because of the pressure We work with the families to apply, but also because the initial police response is carried out by very different officers than those who work in cold case units and missing persons units, who sadly are all too aware of the failings of the initial investigation. So there was never a complete record of her phone conversation she'd had, who she might have called or texted, who'd called her. The CCTV footage from Queensland Rail was never retrieved in full, only up to about half an hour after Monique had gone missing. So the search was never allowed to progress past the park, even though search and rescue said she absolutely wasn't in it. And she's not. She was never found. It's a small park. It was wrong. But we do think that the more we uncover and the more that we take to police, that we are beginning to paint a more full picture of what really happened that day.
And of course, I can imagine the quality of evidence and availability of evidence changes over time if the first investigation was inadequate. What are some of the challenges that you've been going through engaging with that part?
So all of the CCTV footage that would have been extremely useful is lost. All of the telephone data is lost. All the GPS data is lost. I should also say that no witnesses were formally interviewed. So we, speaking to people now, you're talking about 13 years later, and people's memories of what Monique was wearing that day, who might have approached her, all of those sort of things are long gone. So we're starting with essentially a blank slate, and it's really difficult to get anything other than that. But I do have to say that we are making what I think is very good progress towards getting answers and understanding what happened that day. But had the police done their job the day Monique disappeared, it could have been resolved in 24 hours. The tragic part is we will never know if Monique would still be alive if the police had done what they were supposed to do when her mother reported her missing.
And that's the case for so many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, right? The failure of police to take urgent action to view what families understand as a crisis as being something that needs immediate action is what leads to these prolonged, you know, really traumatic processes of missingness. Now, the family has been asking for a Queensland police to issue a $1 million reward for information about Monique's disappearance. Can I ask you about that? What does attaching a reward to information add to this? And how long have the family been campaigning for this?
So we first asked for a reward around 5 years ago, and there's been two failed attempts. There's never been a clear answer as to why those rewards weren't granted. But that obviously hasn't stopped us. And our latest request is a reward for $1 million. And it comes because obviously the family are desperate for answers and information. But the reason we believe a reward is so important in Monique's case is we know of a number of individuals who were either with Monique in those last few days, right up until the time she disappeared, or who were in contact with her, none of whom are her family, but these are people, the majority of whom had known Monique for many years. They know what has happened. They have never been properly interviewed by police. And in cases like this, we believe a reward is very useful in getting people to talk. It's understandable that in some cases, people are afraid to talk, and they need an incentive. And if there's someone who hasn't done the wrong thing but knows and is afraid of the people who have done something, then a reward can help them to start a new life and get the protection and support they need. So this is really about drawing a line in the sand and saying enough is enough. The family have suffered far too long. Now is the time to come forward and tell us what you know. And I will add this. Tell us what you know, because we, through our own investigation, are closing in on the truth. And it's better that you speak now rather than wait until we've figured it out. So it's time for people to cooperate and really understanding that every day they don't come forward is another day the family needlessly suffer, and you are prolonging their suffering. So there's people out there who have to do the right thing, and the time is now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you bringing it back to how Monique's family are positioned in all of this, having experienced 13 years of grief and trauma without any closure. Now, I wanted to ask, just as we wrap up, how can people lend support to the family? I know there's a petition for the $1 million reward. What else can people do apart from signing that petition? What are some steps they can take?
Yeah, so if people would like to, firstly, please sign that petition that's out there. The best way to find us is at the Disappeared Project on Instagram. You can go to our website, disappearedproject.com, and there you can find links. The family have their own personal Instagram and Facebook pages, and they really deserve a follow, because you're also getting information straight from the family about Monique and about their story and their journey. Unfortunately, the media have told a lot of lies and spread a lot of misinformation, and the family is doing an amazing job at correcting the record. So I would really encourage people to support the family that way. We're also in Missing Persons Week this year. There will be events in Hervey Bay, where Monique is from. So if you're in that area, you'll find the posters on our website and come along. And there'll be other events that we'll be advertising soon. And so we're not asking for money. We're just asking that people take 30 seconds out of their day to sign that petition. And that will go a long way to convincing the Queensland government that it's time to issue a reward.
Yeah, I really encourage people to sign that petition. We will have a link to that in our show notes, as well as to the Disappeared Project and to the family's Instagram page, which is Help Find Monique Club on Instagram. And I'll also include a link to Amy's extensive write-up about Monique's disappearance, with interviews with her family talking about what it's been like. Martin, is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
No, I would just really encourage people to talk about it. You know, outside of social media, away from everything else, when you're at home, at uni and work, with your friends, just keep sharing these stories. Obviously, we've talked about other families of disappeared people, and just keep supporting the families, keep turning up for them, because this is when they need you and you can really make a big difference.
Thank you so much, Martin.
Thanks again for your time.
Hi,
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and you just heard a conversation with Martin Hodgson of the Disappeared Project, speaking about the Family of Monique Club's campaign to get Queensland Police to issue a $1 million reward for information about her disappearance on the 22nd of June 2013. Now, again, this interview did touch on some difficult themes, including discussing a First Nations person who has passed away. So if you need to speak to someone, Mob can call 13YARN on 139276 or Yarning Safe and Strong on 1800 959 563.
And now we are going to be joined by Renters and Housing Union Secretary Adu Hani and Branch Delegate Harry Millward to go over some of the most recent changes in Victorian rental policy. Last week, the state government announced their portable bond scheme, which allows renters to transfer an existing bond payment to their next rental property bond when moving houses. Some of the changes we are seeing in rental rights are long awaited, but slow policy changes have proven inadequate in providing safe and equitable housing. And yeah, I'm very keen to hear some of your reflections, Adu and Harry. How are you this morning?
Yeah, good. How are you going?
Yeah, good, thanks. So I thought we could start by going over what we've seen change since the 31st of March and get some insight into the reality of the current situation and what you'd like to see done better. So,
yeah, of course. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say that probably the biggest challenge with any kind of legislative change is uptake. So what we're seeing, at least in my experience, is that while the government can introduce, you know, all these different laws and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
it's really difficult for tenants to actually uphold them.
Yes.
Because of the really big power difference between tenants and landlords. And so the government, like, let's say the government, everything that the government is doing is perfect. Because of that power difference and because of that unequal relationship, it's really difficult for tenants to uphold the rights that they've been given.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that pretty much every renter has felt acutely, and particularly in the last few years, more and more people are being drawn into those power dynamics. Now, I just wanted to correct myself. I meant since the changes we've seen since May 31st. Now, to get into some of the specifics of what those changes are and get your opinions on them, standardised application forms. So the state government is introducing standardised application forms, and on the surface, it seems better than the current chaos that we have when applying for new rentals. But there have been significant privacy concerns, and part of the new policy states that renters must provide photo ID on their application forms. What are your thoughts and reflections of this? Adu, if you want to answer first.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just reflects, again, that unequal relationship between renter and landlord, where renters are having to provide photo ID and, you know, invasions of their privacy just to get a roof over their head, whereas a large number of tenants that we talk to, they don't even know who their landlord is.
Yeah.
They don't even know. They've never met their landlord. They don't know their name. They can hardly get interactions with their real estate agent. So it's really, again, just a product, in my view, of that unequal relationship. And, it's an absolute invasion of privacy that falls on the renter.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen time and time again, I myself as a renter have seen that my information and ID identification details have not been treated with the correct privacy, like, policies, and it's really just putting trust in agents that already kind of have free rein to take care of people's photo IDs for up to 3 years after their rental agreement ends. And then it's also just relying on them to get rid of it if their applications are unsuccessful. So that was definitely concerning reading over the details of that for me.
Hey, Harry here. You also have to remember that a lot of the time that agents aren't actually going to be the same over the full tenancy of the time that a tenant is with that property. So you're not only relying on one agent to do the right thing, you're often relying on multiple agents to do the right thing. And given the complete chaos around how many properties some agents are looking after, and also the, everybody knows that there are unofficial blacklists going on, it really does sort of beg the question as to how much we can trust our information with them when we're getting so little back.
Yes, absolutely. So something to really stay aware of when we're kind of relying on changes that seem positive on the surface, but actually are just relying on dysfunctional systems that haven't been changed at all. Now, Harry, I thought you could answer this one. Rent increase investigations. Supposedly there's going to be additional factors considered in rent increase investigations. What are your thoughts on rent increase investigations based on your work in the field? Have you seen them being successful?
It's a roll of the dice. I'd say generally not. My experience is that CAV has a tendency to not really push too hard on that. A lot of the time, the most common quote-unquote reason for rent increases that members have, in my experience, is comparable properties in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
But things like amenities and space and location are not really taken into account. So you could have like a tiny apartment that is comparable to like a large apartment that's got access to a pool and a gym. But if they've got the same amount of bedrooms and they're in the same postcode, then, like, CAV seems to sort of check them off as valid.
Yeah.
Which is just pushes up the cheapest ones, which then helps push up the more expensive ones, and it just becomes
exactly
this circle that keeps spiraling out of control.
Yeah, exactly. And now maybe both Ardu and Harry, I could have both of your takes on this one. Could you describe some tenant-led alternatives to the current system of challenging a rent increase after it's already raised and relying on the whims of profit-driven housing policy to determine rent prices?
Well, I think, and just on what you guys were just talking about, we've had instances where tenants have had their rent increased because of new builds in the area, despite their home being pretty old. And
right.
So the idea that market rent is this kind of neutral way of increasing rent, it's ridiculous. You can have a house that's 50 years old and the landlord will jack up the rent to the same rate the home across the road is, even if the home across the road is like 20 years younger. But this kind of leads into how, tenant-led organizations can resist this kind of stuff. So Rahu is, and Harry mentioned the kind of limited success that going to, CAV or VCAT has yielded. But there are instances where we actually can go to VCAT, for example, and argue that a rent increase wasn't done properly. But, of course, that relies on the veracity of the institutions like CAV or like VCAT. And so, and this is the same in the trade union sector, the best kind of most effective way to, in our case, lower rents and better conditions isn't to rely on external institutions or the goodwill of landlords.
Mm.
It's to get everyone together and say, hey, this isn't on. We all have the leverage here in withdrawing our rent. If you don't do X, Y, and Z, we'll be forced to escalate action. And when that happens, that's when we see the most results.
Yeah. It's really important to remember that renters do make up a huge majority of residents, and that we need to remember we have power together and we should be demanding our rights, because everybody deserves safe and equitable housing. Harry, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, so there's a few things. When we say demanding our rights, like, what are rights? What rights do we actually have? A lot of people on our side of politics always talk about, the right to housing or the human right to housing, because it's sort of part of an agreement with, some international organization that's never actually upheld. Forget rights. We don't have rights, because rights are, like, upheld inequally.
Mm.
The rights we have are the ones that we can that we can uphold ourselves. The rights that we have are the ones that aren't related to having one specific government elected. Right now we've got Labor, fine. Next year we might have the Liberals. Next year we might have One Nation. The point isn't who's in charge. The point is what we can do to leverage our power as the primary capital extraction of rent to control part of our own rights, to decide what we think is good enough, to decide what we think we should be aiming for. Obviously, in that fight, that yes, okay, you know, we should be using all levers available. Yes, we should be talking to government and pushing for better. Yes, we should be using our legal rights to challenge excessive rent increases, and we do all that. But at the end of the day, it's a mistake to assume that those systems are always going to get better, or that they are going to remain stable, or that whatever is on the books is actually what's going to be upheld.
Yeah, I think that reframe is really, really important to remember. So thank you, Harry. And speaking of government, you are going to speak at the Federal Parliament Select Committee on Intergenerational Housing Inequity today, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm going mostly as a support. I'm going with our policy officer, as well as a few RAHU members to speak about their lived experience. Basically, I think one thing we need to realise ahead of time is this sort of exercise is not going to change policy. It's very unlikely to change policy. Mm. Great to put the stories out there, absolutely. But who's on the panel? They're not renters. They're not people who share those same economic drivers. They're people who have a profit motive to maintain the system as it is.
Yeah.
Some of them might speak more kindly. Some of them might say nice things. But at the end of the day, you know, we've had these conversations before. We've gone to these hearings. We've spoken about public housing being torn down in Victoria. And, hey, it led to a recommendation to stop, and still nothing happened. So I think that it's valuable in that we can put these stories on the record to never let them say that they didn't know. At the end of what we're there to do is to put our story on the record, not under any illusions that that's going to make a big change.
Yeah, absolutely. And getting things recorded and getting more data where there's massive gaps is so important. Just to wrap up today, Harry and Adu, what can people do to make sure their experiences are documented and to continue working together?
Well, if you're in the state of Victoria, you can record any conversation or anything you want, basically. My advice would be just to record as much as you can, write things down, that kind of thing. It's pretty simple. But also remember that it's really hard for individuals themselves to get things done. You might have a successful VCAT trial. You might be able to get something out of your landlord personally, but it's much more likely that you'll win more things or you'll win it all if you talk to your neighbours or you talk to people who also rent under your landlord. And that goes for all kind of facets of life. That goes for your workplace as well. So remember, while it's important to individually do things, or, you know, keep records, write things down, take photos, take videos, it's also really important to remember that you can't do it all on your own. And that's not a diss to any individual. That's just the reality. So you have the most leverage when you're together with the people that you, when it comes to rent, you rent under, or when it comes to work, you work with. So
thank you so much.
I just want to echo what Aru just said. We're so atomized, and that's really a weak point in the chain when none of us are connected, which is something that we as a union are really trying to help solve. Just as far as, like, advice, first of all, you as a renter, you have the right to request that communication be in a specific format. You can request that all things are sent through email, through phone call. You can request that every communication from your agent come through a posted letter, if that's what you want. Whatever you choose, if you're having a in-person or phone conversation that is not recorded, I would really suggest that renters follow up with emails to those agents directly after the after that conversation, because in a month, in a year, whatever, if you have to go to VCAT and they have not explicitly responded to that email saying that your recollection of that conversation was wrong, that can be used as evidence in a hearing, which can be really invaluable when a lot of, you know, you can say that there you've got a good landlord today. You can say you've got a nice agent today. They might not be so nice to you in a few years when the economic strains are on them. So keep those records.
Harry, thank you so much for your insight. And Aru, thank you so much as well. Thank you for speaking on Thursday Breakfast. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you.
You just heard from Renters and Housing Union Secretary Aru Hani and Branch Delegate Harry Millward, who went over some of the most recent changes in Victorian rental policy and how those changes could be reworked to actually serve the need for safe and equitable housing for all.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1pm.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Now, at the top of the show, we mentioned that we were going to be joined by Yanganjara Anangu leader and survivor of British nuclear testing, Karina Lester. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get Karina on the phone this morning, but we're hoping to organize an interview with her for next week's show. Now, Kate, just briefly, what were you going to discuss with Karina?
So we were going to speak about her experience as a second generation survivor of nuclear tests that were held at Emu Field in South Australia. And we're also going to speak with her about, most recently she has been selected as a commissioner on the AUKUS public inquiry, and we're going to speak with her about associated risks with nuclear waste regarding AUKUS, and also her consultations with First Nations peoples and their concerns over AUKUS, and yeah, what the inquiry is hoping to achieve. So I'm very sorry, listeners, that this one hasn't come through this morning,
but that's okay. We will make it happen, and you know, these things happen, and it'll be an important conversation whenever we get it to air. And I'm really looking forward to it, Kate. So hopefully we will speak with Karina Lester next week. And I just wanted to link that into a conversation that we had last week with Meriwale Situlau from the Fiji Nuclear Veterans and Families Association and Samuel Barton, who is the president of the Marshall Islands Students Association in Fiji, because last week was the Pacific Peace Pilgrimage commemorating the 80th anniversary of the advent of nuclear testing in the Pacific. And so we caught up with both of them last week to talk about the pilgrimage and about the history and intergenerational impacts of nuclear testing in the Pacific. And as part of that, delegates from Pacific Island nations met with Aboriginal folks who have also been subjected to nuclear testing on their lands, including Karina Lester. So those connections were made last week, and it was, a really important series of events. And if you want to listen back to any of our past interviews, you can head to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast. Now, Leela, I want to turn to you and ask you for some of your thoughts about our 50th anniversary the weekend. It was beautiful. What do you reckon? I think we should talk a little bit about this and let people know what they missed out on.
Yes, so much you missed out on. So you should be so they had radiothon posters that kind of spanned over the last 50 years. None of them had a year on them, so I kind of just had to guess.
Not all of them.
Yeah, maybe a few, but I was kind of just guessing by the graphics. But I was arguing that they should charge me more for the last posters because of scarcity.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, it was amazing. We did a print run of past Radiothon posters across the years. And we also had hanging above the stage some really big versions of Radiothon posters blown up. It was,
I saw those. I saw the big, huge ones, and I was like, I want that one.
Yes.
But there was some really beautiful stuff. I got some free native indigenous plants to put in my garden, and the advice was just shove them in there. So that's what I will do.
Amazing.
There was also really beautiful stuff that you can buy at 3CR if you ever feel like dropping in, the 40th anniversary 3CR book, which is just covers so much of the history of this area of the country known as Victoria, so much First Nations resistance stories, and multicultural histories.
Yeah, and I mean, it was just incredibly special on Saturday. The event went from 11 to 4 to see how many people were coming through the door to celebrate 50 years of 3CR. I mean, I've only been here since 2020, and it's been such a massive privilege, and I've met so many people and gotten to work alongside so many amazing people and learn from so many folks about how to do radio, about storytelling, about the place that we live in, and about what a community radio culture means. And then to see how this station has played that role for hundreds of other folks was just mind-blowing, just to recognize you're part of something that's so big.
Yeah, the sense of solidarity was really special, to just have I guess, like a kind of inherent understanding about the value of community whilst also holding the fact that the reason we're all here is because we all have unique life and living experiences, and that's all just brought together across generations and across so many communities. It was really, I don't know, I just felt very at peace being in the room.
Yeah, and there was a massive, amazing cake made by Kate Reed. It was shaped like a giant five and a giant zero.
And it was pink.
It was pink.
Everybody loves cake.
Everybody loves cake. And I think people thought that I was stuck on cake cutting duties, but I actually really enjoyed myself and felt a great deal of satisfaction when I finished cutting, I don't know, whatever, the like 200th piece of cake, and the cake had been completed. So I'm very, very glad that people ate cake and enjoyed themselves. I also am just reflecting on a couple of highlights from the day. The West Papuan group performing a beautiful set of songs, Vicky and the Mafalda crew singing as well. The incredible song by Carl Panuzzo naming like all of the shows that are on air at 3CR in one song. Just like, yeah.
That's a marathon.
That is an absolute marathon. Ajax, wonderful vocals, Abe Dunovitz. We heard from Hank on the accordion singing in Russian, I think. And also Greg Siegel, our amazing tech extraordinaire, who has been with the station for a long time, set up a little viewing station next to the stage where people could look at some of 3CR's older tech from across the years. There was an amazing little booth where you could watch a little bit of archival film from the ABC, which was with our past station manager. I think this was from like, gosh, it had to be the 1980s, 1970s. This is terrible recall on my part. But they're asking about why 3CR has a Palestinian show and does not allow Zionist voices on air. And the station manager was like, well, Zionism is racism, so that is why we don't allow that. So it was... Yeah, really amazing to see the history of solidarity with Palestinian folks, reference to that obviously international precedent from the UN human rights precedent around recognizing that connection. And yeah, just seeing that so many people in the room are engaged in various forms of political struggle that all come together in this brilliant station that we call home.
Yeah. And that's... something that I was reflecting on during our radiothon, and just letting you know, you can still support 3CR, but I was explaining what 3CR was to people, and I was like, it's not just an organization. It's not just an organization, but it's actually creates a backbone and a platform for so many unique, like activist groups and collective action over the years, that when you're supporting 3CR, it's not just going to one person, it's actually sustaining lots of different movements that all have their unique value. And I think it's just difficult to understand that if you haven't experienced what 3CR is, but I'm telling you here, and hopefully you can see that in our programming as well.
Yeah, and I think it's very rare for people to see all of the different parts that make up 3CR. I mean, and even saying that, there were tens of, like, oh, gosh, over 20 stalls from different shows, but that is still a very small proportion of the programming that we have at the station. So even having that number of folks who contribute to the station in one room reflected a massive diversity of voices. I realize that we have been ruminating for quite a while now, so we will do a very quick wrap-up for today's show. First up, we heard from Gunajamara writer, activist, and singer Richard Franklin. We then heard from Tash Wark, branch secretary of ASU, about action by council workers. We heard a conversation with Martin Hodgson of the Disappeared Project about the campaign by the family of Monique Club to get a reward issued for information about her disappearance.
And then we heard from Adu Hani and Harry Millward from Renters and Housing Union, who spoke about the latest Victorian rental policy changes.
And that is all that we have time for on today's show, but we will catch you next week, same time, same place, 3CR, 855 AM, 7 to 8:30 in the morning. And for now, we will let you stay on and continue listening to Lost in Science. And remember, again, today and tomorrow are the final two broadcasts of Beyond the Bars for 2026 from 11 AM to 2 PM. So just leave the radio on all day. You will absolutely learn something, and I can guarantee it will enrich your life. Thanks so much for joining us again, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.
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 3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.